From the panel of peril we came, spoiling the plots of several movies. No one has ever known the ending of Highlander. Until now. This is Diabolical, the show where four long-suffering friends dissect film's most dastardly schemes, then compete to improve them. I'm your host, Craig, and this week's movie is 1984's feature-length Queen music video and cult classic swords and sorcery epic, Highlander. So, Peril Pals, pour yourself a nice big glass of Glenmorangie, pull up a seat in your circular library, reminisce about your incredibly long life, and let's get diabolical. Welcome to this week's episode. As host for this week, I'm the clan chief of the Panel of Peril. In a moment, I'll welcome the rest of the panel, who will compete against me at the close of the show in a bid to become the one and only survivor of the gathering, as we each try to come up with the best alternative plan for the movie villain of the week, before we vote to name this week's most diabolical. As ever, I'm joined by three Egyptian men with Spanish names and Scottish accents, all of whom are in league with Lucifer. Please introduce yourselves and tell me, what is your favourite use of a Queen song in film? And first, let's hear from the best, the best, the best.
Hi. Hello, the best, the best, the best here. And my favourite example of a Queen song in a film has to be Don't Stop Me Now in Shaun of the Dead.
I thought it would be. Because you saw that in the like assembly cut, right? When you were in uni, you got to see a rough cut which had a temp soundtrack that turned out to be the real soundtrack.
That's right, yeah. The score itself was made up of cues from John Carpenter's The Thing and Ghostbusters, but Don't Stop Me Now was used for the battering with a pool cue scene, as in the final film.
It would have to be because it's pretty much synced up to it perfectly, isn't it, with the pool cue action going in on the beats.
Oh, yeah.
Next, let's hear from Adam.
Hello, Adam here. I would say it's a nice juxtaposition with my favourite, this film, but I'd still say Flash Gordon, as it's a total different concept to what they do in this movie. Princess of the Universe is a better song than any of the Flash songs, but I think the Flash soundtrack is what it is, and it's sort of a standalone work of art.
Yeah, and indeed, Princess of the Universe from Highlander is my favourite use of a Queen song in film. So a bit out of sequence there for you, but let's end with Ben.
Hi, Ben here. And my favourite example of a Queen song in a film has to be Wayne's World, Bohemian Rhapsody.
My favourite thing about this is I knew exactly what you were all going to pick, and that doesn't often happen.
I had one other alternate choice, which was We Will Rock You in A Knight's Tale.
You've never seen that film.
I've seen it twice. It's there.
What an idiot.
Isn't that like a shitty cover by like Five or something? Gonna rock your baby.
Pretty much, yeah. And Paul Bettany sings it, doesn't he?
Yeah. I'm glad that nobody picked any of the songs from the film Bohemian Rhapsody, much as I enjoyed it.
I haven't actually seen it.
No, I've never seen it.
It's terrible, but it's enjoyable. Don't know how else to describe it.
He's got a lot of traction out of that movie, hasn't he? Bless him. Old Timothy
Dalton.
Who's the guy in that place? Ravi Malek, is it?
The one and only, the wickedly talented.
Turner, you're forever confusing Timothy Dalton and Ravi Malek, aren't you?
Terrence Malek.
No, Timothy Chalamet, whatever his name is.
Timothy Chalamet.
Yeah, Timothy Chalamet, yeah. Timothy Chalamet.
This may come as a shock to many of you because of lockdown and everything, but as we are now living in the year 2024, that's right, when the events of Highlander 2 take place, I thought it would be a great time to try out a new segment, which I'm calling Lowlander Poo, The Sickening. I'll detail three ways in which the various cuts of the sequel rewrite the series' established lore in order to contrive a way to bring back Sean Connery's Juan Sanchez Villalobos Ramirez, two of which will be genuine, which means there can be only one which is false, and it's up to you to identify which. So one, McCloud and Ramirez are revealed to have led a failed rebellion in Earth's distant past, and as punishment, were sent into their future respective places and time periods of Renaissance Scotland and ancient Egypt, destined to battle in a contest to the death, with the winner being given the option to either live out a mortal life or return home to the distant past. Or is it two? McCloud and Ramirez are revealed to have led a failed rebellion on a distant alien world named Zeist, and as punishment were exiled to Earth, arriving hundreds of years apart due to the days on Zeist lasting 100 years, with the winner of the gathering being given the option to either live out a mortal life or return home to the planet Zeist. Or three, McCloud and Ramirez are revealed to be Shakespearean actors from Earth's distant future, where all entertainment is outlawed, and as punishment for putting on productions of Macbeth and Antony and Cleopatra, were sent back in time to their respective places and time periods of Renaissance Scotland and ancient Egypt, destined to battle in the contest to the death, with the winner gifted the chance to live out a mortal life in modern New York, the heart of the arts scene. Two of those exist as cuts of Highlander 2 and 1. I made up.
I'm not going to lie to you, I don't understand anything that was just said.
I kind of zoned out for a bit.
Let me recap. One, two, or three. There you go.
The thing that I remember it being forms part of my plan, so I'm hoping that I've remembered it correctly. I'm saying that number three is the false one, the Shakespearean actor.
Oh.
Right, guys are saying number three is the red herring. Anybody disagree?
Well, I know number two is true. That's one thing I do know.
Mm.
Okay.
I'm going to say number three because it's the only one I can remember.
The other numbers were one and two.
I might look foolish by saying it's one or two, though, so I'm going to go with the one that I know it is, even if it makes me look foolish.
Ben, you sticking with your fellows?
I'm leaning towards three, yeah, but I just might be different just for a laugh. One.
That was really funny.
You made yourself look a right cunt because it was three. What a fucking idiot.
I'll wear it with pride.
But both of those other versions of Highlander 2 are equally stupid. Time now to delve into this week's film, Highlander. The screenplay Shadow Clan that would serve as the first draft for the film was written as a class assignment by scriptwriting student Gregory Wyden during his studies at UCLA. Inspired partly by a trip to the UK which took in the Scottish Highlands and the Tower of London, Wyden imagined the life of a man who might have originally owned the antique armour on display and lived to show it off to tourists in the modern day. He also took inspiration from Ridley Scott's debut film, The Duelists, an account of two men who meet on several occasions over the span of their lives to continue a grudge match to the death, expanding upon that concept to reimagine a duel taking place over centuries instead of years. In the hands of music video director Russell Mulcahy, and with additional rewrites by Peter Bellwood and Larry Ferguson, the understandably somber story of immortals doomed to dance out an endless duel evolved into something more romantic and crowd-pleasing, with fun turns from screen legend Sean Connery as the improbably named Juan Sanchez Villalobos Ramirez, legend of Greystoke Christoph Lambert as the eponymous Highlander, Connor MacLeod, and legendary guy from That Thing, Clancy Brown, as the villainous Kurgan. Brown reputedly received no pay for his heel turn, and lamented the lack of depth in the characterization of his part as the reptilian Russian, whom screenwriter Wyden had originally envisaged as less the gleefully anarchic psychotic killer we got on screen, and more a tortured and embittered victim of his own immortality, having lost everything except the duel, which had finally become the only thing he could cling on to. With a score by Michael Kamen, one of Highlander's key strengths is its Queen soundtrack, largely comprising songs from their album A Kind of Magic, many of which were directly inspired by the plot and key scenes, including Brian May's popular lament, Who Wants to Live Forever, inspired by the relatively brief love between MacLeod and his wife Heather, as well as a snippet of a never-released cover of New York, New York, that surviving members of Queen claim was never recorded in full. At one point, Dune actor Sting had been considered to provide both the soundtrack and the central performance of MacLeod. Much has been made of the historically inaccurate accents, and indeed, Lambert had been cast based on his largely mute performance as Tarzan was Mulcahy unaware the Frenchman spoke almost no English. Meanwhile, Connery reportedly had an accent coach to help with his Spanish accent.
He nailed it.
Fuck!
Yeah, money well spent on that coach.
In spite of such admittedly amusing quibbles, the film remains to me a firm favourite, full of warmth and humour, with a brilliant high concept, a number of memorable quotes, and one of my favourite soundtracks of all time. It gained a cult following and spawned a series of intriguing, if risible, sequels, a quite good animated series, a hardcore anime, and a beloved television series which itself had spin-offs. A movie remake is currently in the pipeline. But what did the panel of peril make of it? So let's start with Adam. What did you think of Highlander?
Well, I've never been a fan of the film. I watched it years and years ago. Didn't get it. I know lots of people do, as you do yourself.
What it is, they can't die.
Yeah, maybe this time I thought I'll pick up on something. And I did. And I think the ambition and the size of the universe that it inhabits is absolutely massive.
You love a bit of world building, don't you?
I fucking love it. But it's like, it's the same thing that I think we all had a bit of a problem with Dark Crystal. They draw back the curtain a little bit and let you have a little peek, and then they close it again. And you're like, oh.
Yeah.
That's the outstanding thing for me. It was the vision for the film. But unfortunately, it's not much going on. I think, actually, Clancy Brown's Kurgan is the best part of the acting side of things. He's deliciously over the top. And I think it's totally appropriate because everything else just seems underplayed and sort of too serious by far. And he sort of brings a different element to it. Why on earth have a Frenchman play a Scot and a Scottish actor who's notoriously terrible at any accent other than his own play an Egyptian Spaniard?
Yeah. I don't know. I've seen him play Russian.
Yeah, exactly. And it wasn't. I wonder if he had the coach for that as well. Brilliant soundtrack, as we've already said. And like you've mentioned now, I'm very, very excited to see what H. Cavill brings to the role and the whole franchise it might spin.
Yeah. I generally don't care too much about accents in film, and especially not in this. I think I like Christopher Lambert's accent because in the modern day segments, it works as a person who's never lived in one place for a long time. Kind of moved around and picked up different bits of accents everywhere.
Yeah.
I thought I was watching Tommy Wiseau for a while.
Exactly. I had very Big Room vibes throughout.
He does a lot of random laughs like Tommy Wiseau does, doesn't he?
Yeah.
Which he also does in Mortal Kombat as Raiden.
He does. It's his thing, isn't it?
One of my notes is, I hate Christopher Lambert's fake laugh and more cum noises from Christopher Lambert.
All right. Well, as Ben has mentioned, movie royalty, acting great, and directing powerhouse Tommy Wiseau. I'm not expecting his appraisal of Highlander to be glowing, but let's hear it.
Well, I didn't hate it, but to me, it was basically a whole story based on Burt Kwok's surprise attacks in The Pink Panther, which I think would be fine, but it was the constant back and forth between timelines that meant as soon as one plot got going, you were pulled out of it, dragged back into the other. And obviously it starts quite slowly when you go into a new timeline each time. So I just felt the pacing was really affected by that. It felt like a penguin's attempt to take off, you know, flapping with gusto, a promising run-up, and then a graceful face plant into the snow.
Is that out of five?
No. I haven't even got to that bit yet. But fear not. There were some elements that I did enjoy, and I think it's the same as Turner, which was the intriguing lore. It's just, I remember the sequel more than I remember the first one, and so it's really implanted in my mind.
Right.
And they really destroy all the lore they set up in that. It's quite sad. So, overall, I give it... Have you seen Highlander? No? No, don't worry about it. Just watch Willow instead. It's much better. And that is out of one. Because, as we all know,
there can only be one. So far, I'm confused by these responses because I think the lore is paper thin. Like, these guys are immortals. Where do they come from? There's nothing. There's no lore.
I agree with you. There's nothing. No.
You don't know where they're from. But you know, there are this group of immortals on Earth who meet occasionally. They're all destined to meet at this gathering sometime in the future.
Yeah.
And so it's more theater of the mind. And what you don't see is you think, oh, okay, well, this is quite an interesting premise. But then they go and tell you what it is, and it's there from another planet. And you're like, oh, for fuck's sake, really?
Well, theater of the mind doesn't really work in cinema. But, you know, the other thing is, as far as the pacing goes, I'd say that's it gets going right out the gate. You get a fight immediately. You kind of know the setup right away. The flashbacks are there, but they don't kill the pace of the main story for me. They just kind of flesh it out.
Oh, they do for me. I feel like this bit's going this way, and then you're like, okay, wait, I've got to go and watch this bit now.
Well, let's hear from the best, the best, the best.
Yeah, I'd say fairly opposite to the first two fellas' views.
Ooh.
I think the first half of the film's the best half, and then it drops off once it settles into the present day timeline for me.
Yeah.
I like, there's some tremendous transitions from the timelines, like the one where Connor is in his massive apartment looking at his fish tank. Yeah.
That is good.
And the camera goes into it, and then you rise up out of the lake.
Yeah.
It's like, God damn, that is brilliant.
I'm not even sure how they did that. I was looking at looking for a cut, and I couldn't see one. It's just amazing.
Really expertly done.
The other favourite is the dissolve from his face to the Mona Lisa on the wall. That's just so great.
Yeah, really good stuff. It's pleasingly cheesy in kind of a way that I think you three guys got a kick out of Flash Gordon and I didn't. The cheesiness and the preposterousness of this film, I did enjoy quite a lot. Like we've all mentioned, Sean Connery as an Egyptian with a Spanish name is just, it's balmy. It's absolutely balmy. And Christopher Lambert, his accent, his Scottish accent, is just absolutely wild. And some of his lines, which we'll get to later on. Jesus Christ. It's
God, yeah.
Like, imagine Scotland that's never existed. Some of the stuff that comes out of his mouth in the past. Some of the effects are really good as well. I like the rotoscoping of the lightning effects when people are having a quickening.
Yeah.
And the fight between the Kurgan and Ramirez where they're knocking that tower down and it's all like polystyrene blocks exploding everywhere.
Yeah, it's great.
Very, very good. I'm not particularly keen on the idea of a remake because I think giving it a big budget would take away from some of the charm, some of the lo-fi charm of this one. And I'm not a massive fan of Henry Cavill either, to be honest. I think he's fine, but that's about as far as I would go.
I like Henry Cavill. Didn't somebody say it's going to be like John Wick with swords or something for the new hire?
It's Chad Stahelski directing it, so that's a plus point. He directed the John Wick films, but still.
Yeah, we know we're going to get some decent action out of it and probably some decent pathos. I mean, John Wick's dog died. I guess that's similar to Heather. Obviously, I'm big fan of Highlander, always have been. It's one of the earliest film memories that I have of seeing Highlander as a very young kid, probably too young. Always really enjoyed kind of the high concept of it. As I've matured as a viewer of film and watched more films, I can also kind of see that the plot's kind of paper thin and that there are things about it that are weaker than the best that cinema has to offer. It was very clearly rushed out by the studio. Yeah, it has this kind of enduring charm to me. I love that Alan North, the captain from Police Squad, shows up in it as a police captain. It's great. Just seeing John Polito in an early role is fantastic.
Yeah.
As a fan of Coen Brothers movies.
He was so slim.
Yeah, yeah. I think Christopher Lambert, I really enjoy his performance in this. I thought he was great in Greystoke as well. He brings a lot of weight to the moments that need it, and he brings a lot of levity to the moments that don't. So I'm always quite impressed with him in this. In terms of the visuals, I'm with Gaz. Gaz, you're the best, the best, the best.
No.
Simply the best, the best, the best. And I'm going to start calling you the best, the best, the best, the best from now on. Yeah, the visuals, I think, still really hold up. I think for the budget and everything, the period hopping is pulled off quite well. You get that scene in the kind of Regency period as well with the duel, and it has Tricky Dicky from EastEnders in it, the World War scene, which I think is really well played as well.
Yeah.
That opening as well, the opening shot that pretends to be a helicopter shot inside Madison Square Garden, I think is absolutely stunning. That camera apparently was specially rigged. It was designed for that shot by the guy who invented the Steadicam.
I was going to say, that was pretty impressive.
Yeah, that's great.
I would hazard a guess that that opening is the best favourite part. Lovely sweaty blonde wrestlers.
Well, let's find out, because let's move on to our favourite parts, and let's start with the best.
Favourite parts. Yeah, I like the opening, but I'll come to that section in my plan, if you don't mind.
Oh.
What I did, because my laptop is incommunicado, I've WhatsApped all my notes to myself, and I haven't got the bold to see where I am.
Did you just say you haven't got the balls to see where you are?
The bold text.
Oh, that makes sense.
So I'm going to say my favourite bit is...
Come on, it can be only one.
Oh, come back to me. This is really hard to look through these notes in this form.
All right, well, let's come back to you. We'll start with Ben.
Let me just scroll through my notes that I haven't bolded.
Well, there's no Microsoft Word on this, so I couldn't just stick it in the OneDrive.
Yeah.
My favourite bit, I really enjoyed the Canon logo at the start.
Oh,
that was really cool.
Yeah, nice to see the Canon logo pop up, yeah.
That was excellent. And then, I got the transition for the fish tank, to the lake, which I thought was really great.
The sequence that follows that I love as well. I always sing BALANCE balance, just whenever.
And then I guess the other bit I kind of ironically laughed at was when they were going out to battle at the beginning. Conor McLeod's only contribution to that battle was shouting McLeod now and again in a half-assed manner.
Yeah.
That was his
only contribution. There was a lot of McLeods at the start, wasn't
it? Yeah.
McLeod.
He's just sort of milling about looking confused.
McLeod!
Yeah, because nobody will fight him.
Yeah, yeah, but it's still quite funny the way he's just like shrugging and sighing.
All right, Adam, let's hear from you next.
Well, I'm going to go for the Marine vigilante guy because it was just like, what the fuck is going on here? And it's just like, what? It just doesn't make any sense to me. Also, just this guy just jumping out of his car and deciding to have at him with an Uzi. So it's just like, one of the most baffling points in the whole movie.
And he gets stuck through the stomach with a sword and raised up. And he's fucking alive in the next scene in hospital bed telling the cops all the info. I was like, what?
In hospital eating a pot of peaches, isn't he, out of his bedside?
This will make you feel better, love. Heal your tummy.
Do you want some semolina?
I wonder if there's another storyline where there is a group of people that are kind of catching on to what's going on.
Mm.
And that was kind of half-assed in the end, I don't know.
Yeah, possibly.
It kind of feels that way, doesn't it?
Like the bat vigilantes in The Dark Knight.
Yeah. Best. Are you ready?
It's quite a small moment. It's after the opening wrestling sequence in Madison Square Garden when, I'm not sure the character's name, the Secret Service-looking guy challenges Connor in the car park. Okay, Fazil. And Connor, mind you, has just been sat down watching wrestling for a couple of hours. And then he stood up in this car park and produces a massive sword from his coat.
Yeah.
Which presumably has been just dug into his shin or something as he's been sat on his metal folding chair at MSG. Getting mad that it was presumably there the entire time. Right up there with the bride taking her samurai sword on her aeroplane in Kill Bill.
I wondered about your reaction to that wrestling sequence. The Freebirds are a real tag team, right?
Yeah, Fabulous Freebirds, a very famous Southern team. Originators of the Freebird rule, where they were the tag team champions, but any two members of the three could defend the belts.
No.
Yeah, legendary team. Michael Hayes, Terry Gordy, and Jimmy Garvin.
Come on, that's way too much information.
Oh, it'll be coming back in my plan. Don't you worry.
Oh, of course it is.
It's a fun little sequence and it's really well filmed and I think gives you a real kind of sense of what people enjoyed about wrestling at the time. So I always liked it. Favourite sequence from me, I'm going to have to go with the sequence that starts with the appearance of Hugh Quarshie as Castlegear when he first produces from his pocket, not a massive sword, but a hip flask of some unknown alcoholic beverage and basically dares McLeod to drink it. Grown man like you shouldn't be afraid of a little boom boom. Then they reminisce about the duel that he had. He has a duel with going Hotchkiss and like shoots him. It's just fucking hilarious, that sequence. shall we move on to favourite lines, if you've all got one? And let's start with the best of best of best.
Oh, my Lord. Oh, there's a lot here. There's a lot here. But let me just find the exact wording. Here it is. Okay. So it takes place in 1536, so in the past for those slow on the uptake. And it is a line from Connor to Ramirez where he says, "You look like a woman, you stupid haggis."
Oh, God.
What a line.
Oh, what an insult.
Oh.
All right, well, I can see that Ben is itching, so let's go next to him.
I did have that one on my list, but my favourite line takes place in 1985 in a motel room. The Kurgan has ordered some light entertainment in the form of an escort. And she enters the room and says, "Hi, I'm Candy." And he just, without looking, says, "Of course you are."
Yeah.
Delivered with aplomb. Brilliant.
Adam, what about you? Favourite line?
Mine's Connor McLeod to his child or adopted daughter, Rachel, when he's saying goodbye. He turns around and goes, "Hey, it's a kind of magic."
Yeah. Just shoehorned in to get the fucking song in the film. Makes no sense.
I thought it was just going to go, "It's a kind of magic," straight after that, but it doesn't. He just says it, and that's it. It's over and done with.
He says it to her in the war zone after he's been shot.
Yeah.
And she sees him come back
to
life.
It's a callback.
Yeah.
Yeah. I still don't really think it fits, personally.
It's not a line after the song. The song was written in response to the line.
Oh, was it? Oh, yeah. Okay. Yeah, it's still a weird line, though, isn't it?
Yeah, it's kind very of odd.
I guess. I think it's only weird if you think the song existed first. But it didn't.
Which in our minds, I suppose it does, even incorrectly.
Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, hard to divorce myself from that idea, I suppose. Yeah.
But I agree with you there. I thought it was a good callback. It was quite cute.
Yeah, I like it, yeah. My favourite line is, and has always been, when Alan North's police captain is out looking at the papers that are detailing the failure of the police to capture the maniac decapitating people, the news vendor says to him, "What does incompetent mean?" And then he says, "What does baffled mean?" I always say that to people who are failing to do something. One of the notes that I made is, maybe don't go and see wrestling if you have PTSD. Because that guy keeps nudging into him and it's making him have flashbacks to the battle that they had.
It's like going to a bonfire night if you've been in the Blitz, isn't it?
Or if you're a dog.
Oh, no. I'm terrified of fireworks. I forgot.
This is a really bad mistake.
One funny line that cracked me up was a police helicopter. "Hey, hold it right there. Come back here."
Be a friend. I have one more line, actually. It's just Shonker's saying in his Scottish, thick, heavy Scottish brogue, "Now then, pendejo." That's a real, I have to pause this film because I'm laughing so much moment.
You there, gringo. Now, before we get to the competition round, if you're new to the podcast and you're enjoying it, please help us to organise a decades-long battle royale in which we face off against other podcasting teams to the death, accruing their power until we become not just the best podcast out there, but also the only one. If you can't commit any time to that, please just tell a friend and leave a review, which will only take seconds. In Highlander, primary antagonist Victor Krueger, a.k.a. the Kurgan, sells his services as a mercenary to Clan Fraser in order to get the chance to claim the head of their mutual enemy, Connor McLeod, furthering his own claim to the fabled prize all immortals seek. But only one may claim. Failing to kill McLeod during that battle, the Kurgan later tracks him down for a rematch, only to find his friend and mentor Ramirez in his place, taking his head by way of compromise. Finally reunited at the gathering several hundred years later, the Kurgan first duels and kills runner-up Cinder Castagir before goading McLeod into a showdown by kidnapping his girlfriend, antiques expert and police forensic analyst Brenda Wyatt. Ultimately, the Kurgan is foiled when MacLeod, now brandishing his fallen mentor Ramirez's lightweight, razor-sharp, yet highly durable, master-crafted Japanese katana, connects with a finesse slash to the throat that whips past his larger foe's heavy broadsword defense, leaving the weight of his own head and the force of gravity to finish the job and release his quickening. But how did the panel of peril rate the Kurgan's diabolical scheme? Was it a good concept, and how well was it pulled off? And let's start with the best, the best, the best.
I guess ultimately, I just don't really understand the concept of the gathering. Is it just fate or destiny, or is the Kurgan manipulating it?
Well, it's kind of like Star Wars before midichlorians in the first Highlander. So MacLeod asks about the gathering, and Ramirez kind of brushes it off, and he says, who knows? Are the stars just pinholes in the curtain of night? Like, they don't want to give you that mythology because, like the Force, it's better when it's a mystery. Once you find out that it's caused by bacteria or, you know, the planet Zeist, it all falls apart.
Yeah.
I just thought, like, the gathering was, like, basically when two best friends go, oh, if we're not married by the time we're 40, we'll just marry each other. Yeah. Same thing with the gathering. If we're not all dead by the time we get to the gathering, we'll just get together and kill each other, all right, until one's alive.
Yeah.
He does say, the few of us who remain will feel an irresistible pull to a far-off land.
By what part of the body?
Judging by the quickening, you know.
Yeah, whoa, hey.
We all know what part that is.
Like a divining rod.
Yeah, so I think if it's something that they're pulled towards, then I don't really understand the point of the Kurgan having to goad Connor into anything. It seems kind of extraneous to the end result. So not a good plan in that case if it's something that's going to happen in any case. Why potentially enrage your opponent?
Right.
Unless that's the point, to enrage him. In theory, he might make a mistake because of that. But I'm not sure. For me, not great.
Well, it didn't work, so I think you're right. Adam, your thoughts?
Why didn't he just get it over and done with sooner? And obviously, he might have had a bit of a trouble tracking him down, but that's partially because he was lazy and didn't bother doing anything about it.
Very much the reason that I picked this film for this podcast. So I've often wondered the same.
Yeah, it's just like, it's just waiting for the gathering. And then when something started pulling, he was like, oh, better go. And that was it, yeah.
Tracks him down to a very small village in Scotland. Has one fight with him where some guys pull him away and he's like, well, I'll see you some other time.
I'll get you next time.
Like some sort of immortal tantric moment, wasn't it?
Oh, it should have been Sting. All right, Ben, you have any thoughts on the plan?
Yeah, I agree with the best of best of best and Adam there. I think it was a terrible plan. And he's waited until a time in history where it's the hardest to get away with murder.
Right.
At any time in the past, it was way easier. So it was a bit silly, really.
I've got a theory about the gathering, actually, which I think is that the prize is the biggest quickening, obviously, of all. But they do seem to get progressively more powerful before that. And what I think is, kind of like Jet Li in The One.
Like a conquer.
Yeah, like a conquer. The fewer immortals there are, the less that power is shared and the more that power they have. So they're kind of like magnets to each other at that point. They feel the quickening because when they show up close to each other, they can feel the presence of each other, can't they? So the stronger they are with that kind of energy, I think the more that pull happens between them.
Right. So with that in mind, I'm giving the Kurgan 4 florets of everlasting broccoli.
Right. Nice.
Very generous, I'd say. Very generous.
Poor the Kurgan.
3 of those florets are for him getting it on with candy.
Yeah.
That was a good part of the plan. That's the best part of the plan.
Wow, chicka, wow, wow.
But of course it is.
This is the part of the show where the panel of peril compete for the title of Season 5's Most Diabolical. Up for grabs is 1 point for each vote, which will go towards the series leaderboard. the Kurgan tried to win the prize first by cutting the Highlander down before he even knew they had beef, and later by goading him into their inevitable climactic duel by exploiting his perceived weakness for love. But what would you have done differently, Adam?
After Ramirez spills the beans on MacLeod being alive and trained by him, the Kurgan begins his tediously long search for the strange accented man. He searches for almost 200 years, and the Kurgan always seems to be one step behind MacLeod. He eventually zeroes in on MacLeod. He has assumed another name and become a sailor, and boarded a ship, travelling to the Caribbean and the port of Nassau in the hope of escaping him. The Kurgan uses his power and influence to board a ship in the hope of tracking down the pesky MacLeod. Whilst on the voyage to Nassau, the Kurgan's vessel is boarded by pirates, and he performs admirably against the cutthroats. The pirate leader, Captain Black Sam Bellamy, recognizes his talent with a weapon and offers parley to the Kurgan. They discuss terms and agree that if the Kurgan will not slay any more of his men and assist them in the accumulation of more plunder, Black Sam will afford him passage on his vessel to help him track down MacLeod. Once agreed, they take control of the Kurgan's vessel, waylaying other ships en route, and head for Nassau. The burgeoning pirate capital is full of sailors looking to make their fortunes, and after a week, they discover that MacLeod is due to set sail that day. The Kurgan, Black Sam and his crew head down to the quayside, where they find that MacLeod has boarded Queen Anne's Revenge and made an acquaintance of Edward Teach, Blackbeard himself. After a few opening pleasantries, Black Sam and Blackbeard crews launch themselves at each other. The Kurgan and MacLeod duel in true pirate swashbuckling style, swinging across moored vessels, jumping down the rigging, and dueling on the quarterdeck. Without the additional hundreds of years of sword fighting practice used to good effect in The Gathering, MacLeod is hopelessly outmatched by his adversary. And when MacLeod traps his leg in a rope noose on the deck, the Kurgan is quick to act, hoists him up by one leg, and effortlessly lops off MacLeod's head in a spinning flourish. As MacLeod's head hits the floor, lightning tickles the Kurgan's bollocks, and he once again knows that he is on the way to becoming King Dick.
So, in a nutshell, pirate Captain Black Sam offers the Kurgan his passage.
Yes!
Right, got it.
The thing, something I missed, I know the Kurgan became a pirate, but where did he catch up with MacLeod? On another ship or something?
No, he finds out MacLeod has gone to Nassau already, has joined.
Oh, so he also becomes a pirate.
But Kurgan just seeks passage on another ship. And while he's going to Nassau, he gets boarded by pirates. Obviously, he defends himself, and then Black Sam comes on, takes him on board his ship, goes the rest of the way to Nassau. Obviously, the Kurgan would fit in well with all the pirate malarkey and stuff.
And MacLeod is at Nassau. Why? Is he become an astronaut?
He's just trying to get away from the Kurgan, because the Kurgan has been on his tail for like 200 years. That's what I'm saying. He's one step behind MacLeod every step of the Kurgan. So MacLeod is constantly moving around, and then he thinks, I'll get away and I'll go to the Caribbean, where this new capital is starting.
Caribbean? Isn't Nassau at Cape Canaveral? That's where the astronauts go to train, isn't it?
It's in the Caribbean, isn't it? Or somewhere, anyway.
Somebody acknowledged my NASA joke.
It's excellent.
Oh, okay. Yeah. So basically, it was like, I didn't do all the preamble of the 200 years leading up to that point, but I thought that this pirate setting would be suitable swashbuckling.
I like the pirate setting, yeah.
The pirate setting was the best thing about it. And the second best thing was the Kurgan getting full use of Black Sam's passage.
And getting tickled by the bollocks, by the lightning.
Yeah, that was good.
He would have almost been tempted to shoot his head off with a cannon. That'd be more fun than a sword fight, wouldn't it?
Oh,
this is the thing. You've got to, some of the stuff you've got to imagine yourself, because the whole sword fighting thing and all that, you've got to think about. Otherwise, I just get lost in description.
Well, I was imagining things myself. I imagined the boat ending up very much like the castle. Just
yeah,
one piece of wood floating on the ocean at the end.
Styrofoam. Let's hear next from the best, the best, the best.
Fade in. Interior, arena cheap seats, Madison Square Garden, night. The National Wrestling Alliance, or NWA, is in town, having been consolidated with Jim Crockett Promotions that very year in order to combat Vince McMahon and the World Wrestling Federation's aggressive national expansion. The roar of the crowd fills the hallowed ground of MSG. Big fat fellas scream epithets in each other's ears. The place reeks of stale beer and BO and wife beating. In the ring, the fabulous Freebirds, Michael Hayes, Terry Gordy, and Jimmy Garvin face off with the bizarro team of Ric Flair, Jim Brunzel, and the Tonga Kid. No idea why they would be teaming up when Flair's legendary Four Horsemen stable was around at the time, but hey, doesn't even matter, right? Conor McLeod, over 400 years old, though he doesn't seem it, looks like absolute shit. He's wearing a disgusting dirty Mac, dad jeans, and white trainers. He also has a 5 o'clock shadow that looks as though mud has dried on his face. Cut two. Interior, the underground parking lot, Madison Square Garden, night. The Kurgan, also well over 400 years old, looking like a gay punk rock icon, decapitates a nameless foe dressed like a CIA operative. Blue lightning fills the air, and cars rev up and explode in that. Cut back to interior, arena, Madison Square Garden, night. The wrestlers brawl out of the ring and into the concession stands towards Connor and the sweaty men who are shouting down his lug holes about the wrestling. Ric Flair uses some of his famous knife-edged chops on crowd members who push and jostle them. Oof, that'll leave a mark. Michael Hayes says something kind of racist to someone in the crowd who accidentally spills a bit of drink on him, as is his wont. These big, sweaty, bleached blonde boys make their way inexorably towards our shabby hero, eye-poking, back-raking, and nut-swatting as they go. Perchance there will be a comically large bag of popcorn to swing around too. Connor himself is being jostled and accidentally nudges into Ric Flair. Hey, what are you doing? Never ever lay your hands on the limousine-riding, jet-flying, kiss-stealing, wheeling-dealing son of a gun! Flair then proceeds in one fell swoop to knife-edge chop Connor's head clean off his shoulders. The crowd roar again as his body levitates encircled by bloom-flame lightning. Flair does a RuPaul-style wig reveal and yanks off his blonde barnet to reveal a greasy black slick of hair and the Kurgan! The Immortals are aliens, after all, and can be in two places at once and also disguise themselves very, very craftily. Fade out.
Well, you very cleverly anticipated my question there. That was way too wrestling heavy. Way too much information about wrestling.
I thought it would be humorously annoying.
It was one of those things.
I reined myself in quite a lot, just so you know.
Jeez.
Has Ric Flair ever cut off another wrestler's head or limb?
Well, it's not Ric Flair, is it? So don't worry.
No, it is the Kurgan.
Oh, so the Kurgan isn't always Ric Flair, just in that moment?
Yeah, just in that particular match.
I thought Ric Flair was maybe his current life.
That's the life I'd pick.
In like 10 years or 20 years, he goes to Linda McMahon or someone and he goes, Ric Flair dies tonight. And then he assumes a new identity.
Wait a minute, that could explain why Ric Flair's still going today.
Right. Well, I assume we have no questions for the best of the best of the best.
I got a question.
Go ahead.
So what changes the Kurgan's plan? Because we see him in the film driving in to New York after the wrestling.
He arrives one day earlier in this version of the plan.
What's prompted that, dare I ask?
Because in the film, his flight was delayed by a day, whereas in my plan, the flight goes as planned.
The flight that he took in his car?
Well, he flies to the city from, let's say, Russia.
Okay.
One ticket from Russia to Madison Square Garden, please, he would say.
That'll be 3 rubles.
There you go, my good man. And keep the change.
You're too kind.
He is driving into the city, but it's only implicit and not explicit that he's not already been there at some point. He might have just nipped over to, you know, Jersey for a fucking...
some potatoes.
Falafel.
Or a cow.
For a gyro.
I don't know why you're protecting the best, the best, the best here, but all right.
It's not protection, just...
You're loving him. You're all over him. Like a greasy gyro.
All right, then. He's so keen. Let's hear from Ben.
Our hero, Connor McLeod, is milling about enjoying his immortality when out of the blue he receives a letter. But not just any letter. It's sealed with wax bearing the unmistakable crest of his old mentor, Ramirez. Dear Connor, it begins. You won't believe it, but somehow I've been magically reconstituted. Meet me in Parrish and bring a nice coat. It's chilly out. Connor is puzzled, having never really understood the whole immortality thing. But the mere thought of seeing his old friend makes him giddy with excitement. As he packs his kilt and his claymore, he searches his belongings for a nice coat, but finds nothing fitting his friend's elaborate definition of nice. So he heads to the nearest tailor and buys himself a coat of undeniable quality and sets off for Paris. But it's not the Paris of romance and baguettes he finds. No, it is 1789. The French Revolution is in full swing, and the streets are a tad more rioty than he had expected. Wearing such a lavish coat, it's not long before McLeod is overpowered by a mob of filthy proles and imprisoned for being a member of the aristocracy. Naturally, he protests, but the double lining and brass buttons betray him, and he is condemned to death. The next dawn, he is led to the guillotine just after some posh bird who is rambling on about being misquoted by the press. Until her head came off, that is. The hulking, masked executioner secures McLeod's head on the block with a sturdy, nay, unbreakable, leather strap. Then whispers, "There can be only one." Moments later, the blade drops and the Highlander's power zooms into the Kurgan, who throws off his mask and shouts, "It was me all along!" You see, it was he who had very cleverly orchestrated the whole thing. The letter, the, well, the letter.
What was the reference that everybody loved there?
The coat of undeniable quality.
It was the shoe of undeniable quality that you said in the Wrath of Khan episode.
Oh, referencing Riff, me. Yeah. Oh,
riffing on you.
That's my favourite quote from the whole 90 episodes we've ever done.
Yeah. We're going to have to get in all different types of clothes now with the undeniable quality.
I don't even think that's the first time I've put it in. I think I've even put in shoe of undeniable quality in the past as well.
Yeah.
Because that's such a nod of respect.
I like the idea of him being guillotined in Revolutionary Paris and almost did that myself. But my first question is, how does he buy a coat for someone else from a tailor?
What?
Don't tailors measure you when you go to a tailor?
Yes, so McLeod buys his own coat. He goes to a tailor and gets himself a coat for himself.
I thought he was getting a coat for Ramirez.
No, Ramirez just told him to wear a coat because it's chilly.
Oh, I see. Okay. I thought he was buying a coat for him.
But we've also seen in present day that he's got terrible dress sense. So why would he, in the past, have a coat of undeniable quality?
Because he's thinking, I'm going to see Ramirez here and I want to impress him because he's my old mentor. What would he choose? Oh, that'd be fun if I kind of out-peacock him, the stupid haggis.
Yeah. Yeah. I thought you were also referencing Highlander 2 a bit, because when Ramirez is resurrected in Highlander 2 on a stage during a performance of, I believe, Hamlet, he then goes to a tailor in Scotland where he pays with his pearl earring and gets a fancy sort of tweed riding suit made for him.
And I don't remember it that clearly.
Yeah. Well, does anybody have any more questions for Ben before we move on to me?
Can we just all agree now that it makes more sense than the Kurgan being Ric Flair and in the car park?
It's quite a big gambit, though, isn't it, that he'd instantly be arrested as a member of the aristocracy?
Were you in Paris in the French Revolution? It was mental.
Maybe I should've seen it. Maybe I
was. Were you there?
I went there on holiday and went to the Palace of Versailles, read all about it. Bloody nuts.
Yeah. But what about the tailor who made the coat? Were they guillotined as well? Because Paris is like a fashion capital, isn't it? So what sort of anything goes.
Oh, yeah. He didn't wait to get to Paris to buy the coat. No, he's like, he got it on his way because he knew it was going to be chilly. The letter said so.
When you get there and there's like somebody with a new and sort of off-kilter sort of fashion, they'll be like, oh, get him.
Oh, sacré bleu, look at him.
Yeah. Sacré bleu, look at his jacket.
They're all really starving, and that made them a bit grumpy, and that's why they overthrew the aristocracy.
Hungry.
I reckon they probably would have eaten his coat rather than guillotined him.
It was a leather coat, why not?
All right. Next, let's hear from Craig. Listen, the Kurgan's sword is cool as fuck. It's so massive. It comes in bits that are presumably keistered in order to bypass airport security and has to be assembled at your hotel. Then, as if that wasn't enough, it has those two tiny little swordlets that flick up out of the crossguard when you click the little button. It's cool, yeah, but it's impractical. It's unwieldy. Even for a big dude like the Kurgan, swinging it around takes effort. And yes, those two little stablings are obviously doubly as cool as a switchblade, which is already like a bazillion cool. But even a gruff, tough, manly man like the Kurgan does a little timid, twitchy blink when they come out. Ramirez's katana, on the other hand, is an elegant weapon from a more civilized age. Yes, it's pretty and dainty and flamboyant, and it doesn't really go with the skulls, feathers, and leathers look. But pretty soon, everyone who's seen him using it will be dead. So, Kurgan, he says to himself as he carries out this inner monologue in his cracked mind, now you've killed the Spanish peacock, why not see how the other half live? He picks up the Japanese sword, and as he gives Heather a goodbye kiss on the hand, he's on his way. And so it is that the Kurgan becomes a fancy boy, all jodhpurs, coattails and powdered wigs, at around the same time as MacLeod and Castlegear are on their jollies, getting pissed and fat-shaming Regency wives. The darling of society, the Kurgan delights nobles with his tales of rape and pillage, the sort of shit they'd never do but absolutely lap up stories about. He's also the best at fox hunting, torturing the poor creatures with his savage dog breeds. The Kurgan watches MacLeod's duel from a lovely swing, the immortal sixth sense mistaken for drunken queasiness, and once he's seen the fool run through, swaggers in to perform the coup de grace on the inebriated and wounded Highlander. With him out of the way and no one else capable of besting the Kurgan, prize is as good as his.
Would these kind of fancy people whom he becomes a fancy boy to assimilate into not think that his neck scar is uncouth or...
vulgar.
Wears a big rough collar.
Damn. He's thought of everything.
It's always hidden. And if anyone were to spot it, you'd say he had a saucy love affair with Count Dracula.
What prompts him to take the sword this time when he left it in the film?
The fact that I rethought his plan to make it better.
Makes sense.
Of course.
I'd say in the original timeline, he looks at it and goes, oh, that's a bit Nancy. Kind of like it. But I've got a reputation. But then in my version, he goes, but I am going to outlive everybody whose opinion I care about, so I might as well become fancy, and then I can go back to being a bad sod after.
Okay, well, here's my question that may well pull your plan to pieces.
All right, okay.
Have you ever tried to open a door that you thought was really heavy and then realised actually quite light? It was lighter than you expected.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
What happened?
Momentarily, I was shocked and it opened quicker than I thought. And then I just carried on with my day and life.
Yeah, so the Kurgan who's been fighting with a broadsword for many, many centuries, we presume.
Yeah.
Now got this really light sword. I don't think he's going to be able to handle it. He's going to be shocked.
He's also got centuries between the time that he leaves Heather and the time that he meets McCloud and Castagir again.
To get used to it.
To practice.
Yeah, yeah, but old habits die hard. You've heard that saying, haven't you?
He might be like one of these modern men that has a big car because he's lacking in other regions, potentially. And basically, for him to have like a little sword compared to his big sword feels less of a man and a bit less confident.
No, don't think he cares about that. He's a fancy boy now.
Okay.
He's not into your macho world anymore. Now he's all about cucumber sandwiches and
jigs.
And harpsichord solos.
Ménage à trois. That's one of his favourites. Some hoop-tightening diabolical schemes there, but there can be only one, or two, or three, or four winners, so who will get the votes? Now, first of all, we had Adam's pirate plot. We had Adam's pirate booty.
Ooh.
Oof.
And we had the best Ric Flair death chop. We had Ben's revolutionary Paris guillotining. And finally, we had my General Katana swap and drunken duel decapitation. So, start with the best.
Well, I have voted for the fancy boy and Craig scheme.
That's one for me. All right, then. And Adam, who have you voted for?
I, too, have voted for Barry Kurgan and Craig.
Oh, beautiful. Ooh. Fancy boy. And Ben, who have you voted for?
Well, I'm a sucker for a pirate story. I voted for Adam.
Thank you very much.
I also enjoyed the pirate story. I enjoyed it all, but because I almost did this plan myself, I felt it was only just unfair to vote for Ben.
Oh. Thank you very much.
So, the best. What has that done to the series of five leaderboard?
Well now, in the lead with 12 points is this week's host, Craig.
Ooh.
Oh, yes.
Just behind with 11. It's Ben.
Tickling the rear.
Creeping up.
In third, with 9 points, is the best.
That's you.
And last place with 8 is Adam.
Oh, very close now. Very close.
Tis.
10 episodes to go.
Oh, yeah.
We're at the halfway mark.
Rattling by.
At the halfway mark, it means that the next host in the rotation will be Ben. So, what is your pick of movie for next week, Ben?
Next week, gentlefolk, we will be watching one of my favourite films of all time. It's Napoleon Dynamite.
Ooh.
Oh. And that wraps up this episode like a sheep's stomach stuffed with meat and barley. Thank you for listening. And if you want to live forever, make sure you subscribe, hit the bell, and leave us a review on the very platform on which you're currently listening. You can follow us on social mediums at Diabolical Pod. Next week, we'll be competing to improve on the diabolical plot of Uncle Rico in Napoleon Dynamite. Until then, remember what Ramirez taught you. No fighting on holy ground.
It's a kind of magic. It's a kind of magic.
One dream.
One mouse.
One hole.
Do you know why there's an echo on that recording of Sean Connery giving that little monologue at the start? It's because he wasn't available to do it, so he recorded it.
Because he's dead.
In the bathroom of his Spanish villa. Which had an echo.
I'll do it in the bathroom. Now leave me alone.
Do it in the shitter.
While shitting...